refugees were coming from Central America by large numbers. And our immigration service, basically, to make a very long story short, was not treating them as refugees. In other words, they were coming and they would get picked up by the Immigration and Refugee Service and deported back to El Salvador or Guatemala from where they came. Some of these people, when they were sent back, were killed, or they were tortured, or and many of them faced the threat of that happening if they were returned. Our government has signed the 1967 Protocol on Refugees, which says that if a person flees persecution for reasons of race, religion, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion, they shall not be deported back to where they fled from. And that arose out of the Geneva Conventions, was made more concrete in the 67 Protocol, which then was actually even incorporated into one of our civil laws called the 1980 Refugee Act. And the exact wording from the 67 Protocol was put in that law. Well, we found as people along the border that people were being deported anyway, even though our government had signed this law, people were being sent back anyway. We even began to hear about some of them being killed. So the sanctuary movement developed because we tried all the different channels. We tried paying bonds for people to get them out of jail and finding lawyers. When we would get a lawyer to represent them, the judge would deny their case and order them deported. So we found two things happening. We found, first of all, that refugees were not being treated fairly. They were not being treated as refugees. Secondly, we didn't feel the story about what was really happening in Central America was getting out. And there was a conflict between what our government was saying about what was going on there, which in the early 80s was basically that these people are just leaving for economic reasons. And of course, that was to defend our foreign policy, which was to support the very government that was killing the people, with the Salvadoran and Guatemalan governments. And so a movement developed across the country where people used a form, we think, of what we call nonviolent direct action, where we would openly tell the public and the government that we would be protecting Central American refugees, that we would give them sanctuary. And sanctuary comes from an idea that we find in the Bible. Other cultures have the idea of sanctuary, especially Arab countries have a strong idea of sanctuary. There are many, it's a pretty strong concept in culture, and it's strong in the Bible. So what that ended up happening was a real conflict between mostly church people, they weren't all church people, but government and church, in terms of the government saying, you're breaking the law, these people need to be deported. Us saying, no, you're breaking the law. The government is breaking the law. And at first, people were saying, no, they were saying, we should call this civil disobedience. They were saying, we should say, we're breaking a law so that people will notice that this is a bad law and try to change the law. But then we looked at the law and we said, no, the law is fine. What's wrong is the government is breaking the law. So now, there, of course, we have in our, by now, after 200 and some years, the U.S. government has many laws. And part of the duty of a judge or a jury is to decide, okay, which law applies here. the judge in the sanctuary case, and by the way, many people were indicted and then brought to trial for protecting refugees. The judge said the only law that applies here is whether these people had papers when they crossed the border, or had the right stamp in their passport, or whether they... We said, no, the 1980 Refugee Act applies. We said, the conditions in El Salvador apply. We said, the international law that we've signed on to agree to applies. But the judge in the case said, no, you can't talk about the 1980 Refugee Act. You cannot talk about the conditions in El Salvador, what's causing people to leave. You can't talk about international law. So many of these people were convicted. During the trial, or before the trial, they sent secret spies into churches. They had hidden microphones on, and they came into our church, and they were especially notorious for coming into one of our Bible study groups, and they monitored and listened to the Bible study group. So what I wanted to talk about then today was that aspect of what we learned about freedom of religion and possibly where we're at, what we learned about that, what some of the crucial places are in this idea of freedom of religion.
Before you get into that, could I ask quickly what happened to the convictions on appeal? Were they overturned?
No, they were convicted.
And then,
they were sustained in the Ninth Circuit, and then they tried to appeal to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court didn't hear the case.
Okay.
At the same time, much earlier, we had brought a lawsuit against the government called the American Baptist Churches versus Ed Meese, claiming that the government was the one that was breaking the law. And that lawsuit was finally settled out of court with the government admitting that they had treated the refugees unfairly. So at this case, at this point, with these two different law decisions, one the civil suit that the churches brought against the government, the criminal case that the government brought against church people, we have really two opposing decisions. One that was upheld by judges, the other where the government recapitulated and said, all these refugees that we ordered deported don't have to be deported because we did this wrong. And it never really has not been resolved. So this is an illustration of what we have in the law as well, is that we think that, I guess we kind of maybe go through thinking that the Supreme Court is somebody has all these things organized, and that our law, that this law comes before this one and this one and this one, whereas it's not really usually the case. It's that there can be two very diametrically opposing opinions existing at the same time within our legal system. I don't know if any of you are lawyers here. Are any of you? No. And I can't explain all that, there is just a big body of law that's built up now. And what happened with our case, though, is that we brought a different civil suit against the government for violating the First Amendment of the Constitution, the freedom of religion. We said that the fact that these people came in and secretly tape recorded and used that evidence against us was a violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution. Or just the fact, we said, that they came in and secretly tape recorded without asking permission and disclosing who they really were, that they violated the First Amendment of the Constitution. And we base that on the concept, which is pretty basic to, we felt, the whole concept of freedom of religion, which is trust. That we based it on looking back on the history of the way religious groups have been persecuted. And religious groups are usually persecuted, broken up by the use of terror, by the use of fear. And that any time a government, a wide-ranging, a big group like government comes in and inserts fear into a religious group, that it's really not going to be good for the gathering. So the whole idea of trust was the way we were coming at it is what we felt was violated. Well, we early on learned that the judge in our case, now this is a completely different judge than what I was talking about in the sanctuary criminal case. We brought this lawsuit against the government, and the very first hearing we had, the judge threw it out of court. And in doing so, he said, well, an individual can go to hell, but a church can't go to hell. And so we went, what? What does that mean? And then he went on in his written decision of why didn't have what we call standing in court. Was he said that if an individual would have brought this case, he might have heard it. But he said that the church, as a group, doesn't have standing. And of course, that really outraged us, because the whole idea that we thought was violated was the connection between people, the community, which is something that exists between people. You don't have a community of one person. So we appealed that to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, and there a three-judge panel decided that yes, churches do have standing as churches, that you don't need to bring a lawsuit just as an individual, that churches. And an interesting thing occurred was that they declared also you don't need to be incorporated. You can just be a free association of people that call yourself a church, and you would have standing, or call yourself some other kind of a religious group. And as a group, then you could bring a lawsuit. So the reason I talk about this is because that is the first time that's ever been ruled on in court. And so if you find that you have a government spy in your church, you can actually, as a church, then come and sue. And there's some law in the book saying that you can protect yourself. And then after that, we decided on that one point, do we have standing? That's all these three judges ruled on, is can churches come into court as churches and sue the United States government? Or I guess they could sue some other group that was spying too. But then it went back to the district court. Our government is, the federal government is divided up in court systems by federal district courts, and then those are all lumped together into circuit courts, of which there are nine. We went back to the Arizona District Court. And after, this is a five-year process that we're in. After that, a judge finally ruled that what the government, he issued what he called a declaratory judgment, that what the government had done was illegal. Their method of investigating was wrong. And he didn't fine them anything. It was just a declaratory judgment. We didn't ask for money. We didn't ask for any, because we felt if we asked for money, this would mix up the whole issue. What we wanted clarified was this whole issue of can government agents come in to any church anytime and secretly tape record your worship services and that.
Did that have any bearing on the criminal complaint against the refugees that had given sanctuary?
We think only in the sense that the pressure it brought. It never, because when the judges ruled on those cases, for example, the timing was wrong. Those kind of issues were being decided actually before we got done with our appeal of that case. We do think, though, that the signal that was sent to the government that we will continue to fight these things, that we won't just back down, really helped, because we had brought the American Baptist suit, we had brought this suit, there had been a number of other, and there were other things that we were doing at other levels. For example, we were continuing to try to publicize the plight of the refugees. I guess the thing that we learned, one of the major things that I learned and we about working on a justice issue like this, is that the courts are only one piece of society, and they're only one piece of what's going on. And that if you're trying to work for justice in a particular arena, especially something as large as thousands of people's lives, like we're involved in this case, and the whole principle of whether a government was going to really live up to its commitments, international commitments, to protect refugees, and above that, whether our government and ourselves as a people were going to live up to just basic human standards, that you do not send somebody back to the death squads, which would be like sending somebody back to the death, to the gas chambers, which would be sending someone into any other kind of extremely dangerous situation. That if you're working on that level, we learned that there are, in our contemporary society, there are many levels. There's the grassroots organizing that has to be done to just educate people and in churches and other groups. There's the level that you have to work with the media, which is something sort of constant that has to be done. Both of those two need to be done in an almost constant way, or a pretty, if the government is the one that is after, that is opposing you in that working in different levels there, one would be in the legal realm, like working on in the courts. Another one is working on people in Congress. Another one is sort of what you might call just rallying people, gathering people, those kind of things. One of the things that we found out in this lawsuit, in terms of getting back to this whole idea of freedom of religion, is that if a government spy comes in, one of the things that, which is sort of a catch-22, that the judge said, is that the spy needs to be invited. And so what he basically did was rule out a secret spy by saying that. Now, if you invite somebody, obviously, and they don't tell you the truth about who they are, that rules out that they're really doing it. But they based a lot of their language on the idea of invitation, which comes out somehow in legalese. We are basing more of our interest in the idea of trust as a church, and in the idea that a government, any government that sends secret spies and agents into a religious gathering of any kind is going to break down trust, whether they think that's their intention or not. some of the background of what was happening is the people that spied in our church really had no experience in the law at all. One of the guys had smuggled Mexican people back and forth or into the United States, and then he would smuggle guns back into Mexico, and he was arrested by the Immigration Service for doing that. And the Immigration Service then made a deal with him and said, if you will come and work for us, we won't put you in jail. And so this was the guy that was spying in our, this very sophisticated lawyer type, you know. No, he wasn't. He was a person who didn't really know about what the law might be, or he didn't know anything about the theory of freedom of religion or separation of church and state, or those kind of things. He didn't know anything about that. He was just doing that so he wouldn't have to go to jail.
He was a coyote.
Yeah, coyote. The coyote is. So I'd like to just open it up to questions or discussions about...
Why don't you give him money for all of this? You don't go to courts and lawyers without any money.
Yeah.
Who footed the bill for this?
Okay. It happens that...
You know, it doesn't have to be...
We prayed a lot. It's true. This is something that I learned, that in an issue that I guess I'd like to say keep stirring the pot. What happened was, after this happened, what we first tried to do was to get hearings in Congress about the freedom of religion. And while we were trying to get these hearings, we also did another thing, is we got a kind of a, what we might call high-level group of people, very visible group of people together, and we had a conference about freedom of religion, and we asked the press to come. And like, for example, Father Drinan, who had been a priest who had been in Congress before this present pope said that priests can't be in political office, he came and spoke, and three or four other pretty well-known people. And then at that same thing, we told our story of how the spies had come into our church, and how after we'd had this, people knew about the spies, we could never get our Bible study group back together again. Everyone was afraid. And the other churches that were spied on had the same kinds of stories of people who just completely would not come back to church anymore. And so we had this conference, and at the conference, and a lawyer came forward and said that my wife, she was also a lawyer, was at one of these worship services. And they found out that this had been, the whole service had been tape recorded, and it was part of a transcript that the government had. And so then this lawyer, who happened to be a member of the largest law firm in Arizona, said, we will do the lawsuit for free. And I think that never would have happened if we hadn't continued to try to keep telling the story. And that, I think, was sort of the key to it, is that those of us who didn't have a lot of money and weren't in typical power positions kept trying to tell the story and get others to tell it and get other people to hear it. And so that's what really kind of made that happen. And so that's how it happened. And so I would say that if you're ever in a situation like that where you really need that kind of thing, don't stop with just one no or... You know, just keep stirring the pot. And this whole kind of relationship between getting press and getting people concerned and getting people outraged and those kind of things are just, that's how movements are built. That's how they work. Is one level, this is a very important thing that we learn. One level will feed another. If you get for example, something in the press that sort of says to people, this is an issue, then you'll also have a little bit easier time getting people to talk about it in church. I think, and in some ways it's sort of a sad commentary about our culture, that people won't talk about things or recognize them as an issue until they're on TV or in the newspaper. And the other thing that we all need to learn from that, though, is unlearn some of that stuff, which is to say, when I start seeing a person or a group of people violated, I shouldn't wait until the news media or the government says that this is an issue. In other words, I should try to define in my own conscience what is going on. And generally, I think we're gifted still with enough people in the grassroots that people, there are lots of people that are able to do that, are able to say, here's something that's happening, we need to start talking about it, we need to start doing something. And that, of course, has a lot to do with freedom of religion, because as soon as people also are, not only are people numbed in their conscience, but are also afraid, that is one of the things that we maintained in this whole lawsuit, is that the freedom of religion and the freedom of conscience and the freedom of association is extremely necessary for an open, healthy society, because if people are afraid even to say, you know, even to talk, say, in their Bible study group and say, I think the government is maybe breaking the law, or to say something, I know these people are from another country, but they seem to be being treated unfairly. If you are thinking that by saying that, you're going to go to jail, or that not that you're maybe going to go to jail, or you're just going to be overheard by a government listener, you're going to be less likely to say that, even though you might think it's true. What did you say, Ellen?
Or you might disappear as in Argentina.
That's really what happened in Germany a lot. Mm-hmm. That people were simply too afraid to say something. Mm-hmm. Which is another story, which does not excuse anything, but there was a lot of that. The people mm-hmm. did not know who they could trust, and they simply couldn't talk about it.
I think the publicity is the main issue, frankly. And we kind of live under the ideal expectation that we're government of laws. Mm-hmm. But saving face is bigger for a politician than the laws involved. Mm-hmm. Not to be too cynical, but... Mm-hmm. And if only because there's such a proliferation of laws at the state and the local level, and, mm-hmm. And there are different laws. Looking at the immigration issue from another angle in Hillsborough and Eastern Washington during the same period, in the Yakima Valley and in the Willamette Valley, was a time of just virtual historic migration.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is economic migration. And to hear you say that there are 400 Salvadorans deported daily under the allegedly
monthly
because they were not political refugees. Well, I know that at the same time most of the economic refugees were not being deported. What that says to me is the government was targeting the Salvadorans somehow.
Because
the economic migration was out of control already. There was a proliferation of green cards, the black market, green card market. There's just no way the government could keep up with that. They finally gave up. And besides, there was the big farming interests that, had a lot of political power.
Well, there's an issue that now at a whole different level is that the thing that we discovered about the Immigration Service is that at its level of funding, and even if its funding were quadrupled, it could never do the job that people think it's doing. And the border, we have the largest border in the world where what you call a first world country meets it. And for years, and for centuries anyway, I have a friend whose family's from Mexico, and he says that most people that are North Americans even think different, that are sort of gringo North Americans, think differently than people that have grown up in Mexico or the Southwest. And most people who grew up in sort of Anglo education think that migration in this country has historically been from east to west. But most people that are from Mexico or Latin America think, and actually even a longer historical period, think that migration is north to south. And
south to north
and north to south. That's the other part of it too, is that there's been historically both north to south and south to north migration. And so that is just the direction of movement is, and so you have, if you take a look at the names of the places in California or Texas or Arizona, they're mostly Spanish names. Much of the Southwest was part of Mexico for a long time. The oldest families in New Mexico and Arizona have Spanish names. So that border there is means more to people who came much later than it does to people whose family roots go farther back. And so that's a part of it. The second part is what I said earlier, is that the Immigration Service is simply impossible for them. So they pick up as many as they can, they deport as many as they can, but that is only a sort of a drop in the bucket. And for Mexicans, have a big advantage too, is because they're only deported to Mexico. And that's usually just on the border. They're usually taken down in buses to the border of Mexico, and then they just come back. If you're Salvadoran, you're deported all the way back to El Salvador. Then you have to come all the way through Mexico again if you want to come to the United States. So most of the folks that are around here are from Mexican background, I think. Around Chelan, that's what
In Oregon, it's...
Is it?
It is.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of Guatemalans.
A lot of
Guatemalans as well. And then further south, Chile. Colombia. It's all kinds of... Yeah. It's a really nice community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, the black market on green cards is not something the Immigration Service can control. They can try to arrest people for doing it, but it gets done all the time. And so forth.
We noticed when we came from Chelan that there's Mexicans, mid-Mexicans, and signs were written in Spanish in the bathrooms. Now, are they green card and stay so many months or stay all year round as a community, or are they a lot of illegals that go back? We're familiar with it in California, San Diego area.
Yeah. I'm not sure. A lot of people said that a lot of folks around Chelan now are like second generation people getting mm-hmm. to be in that are staying, I'm sure most of the folks are first generation. Now, whether they have papers or not, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's every level. Sure, there are people with papers, people without papers, people with counterfeit papers. I mean, I'm sure it's It's everything.
Do they come for the harvest? What do they come
that's,
for?
I think that was the beginning part of it, yeah.
Yeah, they come for labor.
Yeah, it used to be migrant labor, and anymore they're just getting out of Mexico, just getting out, really. And one reason you'll find different nationalities concentrated is that a group of Mexicans would come and settle in, and then they'll invite their relatives, and the Guatemalans will settle in Washington County, west of Portland. You probably have 10 to 15,000 undocumented aliens living there year-round. There's no way you can keep track.
I think a lot of this is mixed up with a little bit of what Ron was saying at our hunger awareness talk. And, Ron Dwyer Voss, a little bit, it's so much of it seems to me is, I used to like to tell this story that in some ways what happened with Salvadorans was an extremely ironic twist in history, which I guess is the way God works, is that Reagan pretty much decided that he wanted to sort of win the war in El Salvador. And so he put millions of dollars into funding the military in El Salvador. I mean, just $1 million a day for a while that was going to El Salvador to win that war. And by using the military alternative in that situation, rather than some kind of negotiation, some kind of trying to nurture a more broad-based society, because the society he supported was a very hierarchical, just a few rich people run everything, and that was pretty much what he, the side that he supported. But during that, and by choosing that military alternative, he pretty much guaranteed that thousands and thousands of people would come out of El Salvador. And Salvadorans came to the United States before this war, but not in large numbers. There were some here, but not very many. And you can mark that when the war really heated up and the death squads became violent and the people by the thousands started coming out of El Salvador, that's when the big migration came. And so to the point that now Los Angeles is the second largest Salvadoran city in the world. The largest is San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. Second largest is Los Angeles, California. And that is all because of Reagan's policy of war. And so there's this ironic thing that if you really try to figure that war is the solution, or coercion or extreme pressure on people is the solution to things, it almost never works. I think that's the thing we need to wake up to, is if our economic system continues to put so much pressure on people as well, the worldwide economic system, I'm saying, if it keeps producing so much poverty and we don't deal with that issue, the immigration issues just cannot be dealt with on its own. There's no way we could ever make a big enough military to guard our borders if we don't deal with it. Yeah.
What's the current policy in El Salvador and under the current administration, and then what's the current level of migration from that country in the U.S.?
Well, when I was there for the elections, and a few things, I met a number of people that had come back to El Salvador. I met from the United States, and they were living in El Salvador again. That in 1989, there was a negotiation between the FMLN and the guerrillas and the government, and they signed these peace accords, and then they had these elections last year. The far right wing candidate won for president, but a number of FMLN and people more sympathetic to the FMLN, which is, for lack of a better term, the left-wing group, got about 25% of the Congress, and the right-wing got about 60%, and some people in between got other ones. That's kind of historic in El Salvador because opposition people have never even had that much, not even come close. And there's a lot more political awareness that there is an alternative now in El Salvador. And so when Bishop Gomez was here this summer, he was saying that he sees some hope because Salvadorans are at least finding a few alternatives to the historic control that a few families have had over the country, and using the military and economics to control the country. So not as many Salvadorans are coming now as used to come. But what happened with Reagan and setting this in motion was, though, that now, for generations, El Salvador and the United States will be linked because families are linked. There are all kinds of families that live here now, and at least for a generation or two, until people lose that link with their family back in El Salvador, people will continue to come because they will have somebody to go to. And until possibly, if we hope to God, the world economy can start being more equalized, then maybe people won't feel the need to come here so much. But now it's like, for example, the sanctuary movement for Salvadorans really isn't that necessary because almost anyone has a family member up here. And they just write to their family, and if they need to get a coyote at the border of Mexico, they pay a coyote and they come across and they go to their family. And their family takes care of them. And so it's not the same situation it was before. And people are not fleeing as much for fear of their lives. Now it continues to be more Guatemalans. And now I'm hearing there's a Presbyterian couple who's doing work in the Skagit Valley, that there are a lot of people coming now from Chiapas, which is the place, you know, where the Zapatistas have organized to try to change the economic equation in southern Mexico, where the Indian people mostly are the ones that work the land and don't get paid much. And you've been hearing about that, I think, in the news. But he's saying that he's finding in the Skagit Valley that there are women and children who do not speak Spanish. By that I mean they don't speak English either, they speak an Indian language from southern Mexico, which is what we found early on when Guatemalans started coming, that first men would come, but then if women and children were coming, that means that whole villages were having to leave their village. And because the women and children usually wouldn't come unless they were forced out. And if that's happening in Chiapas, there's something going on with the Mexican army or some kind of fear that's going on in southern Mexico. So that we're getting very little news. This is something that Bishop Gomez was also telling us, is that the Mexican government has a lot of control over the news media in Mexico. And also has a real sensitivity to how they appear to the outside world. And so there's probably a lot going on that we don't know about in Mexico. So that kind of got away from, but there's still a lot of Guatemalans and a lot of Mexicans coming, and some Salvadorans.
Do you think that gap, the new trade agreement, will have any beneficial effects? Yeah. The economies there?
Or is it
still a tractable problem?
Bishop Gomez was saying that he feels like this is an agreement for rich people. That this is going to open up multinational corporations their ability to really take advantage of the Mexican labor market and to move factories there, and that Mexico does not have a good history of protecting workers, and unless somehow Mexicans can form labor unions that really work, in other words, that are not broken by the army, that the prices can come up, they're afraid that it's really not going to work. One of the problems we're at, I feel, in this stage in history, that we've noticed working in the Salvadoran solidarity movement, is that governments and large corporations have made kind of a science out of breaking unions, and that they're really good at it, and that they know how to get at a labor union early on, how to, and there are many levels of at how to do this. What they did in the Salvadoran society was that if a labor union would start to form, the Salvadoran government would actually secretly organize an alternative labor union that would draw off the energies of the one, and then one that would then not function and would not really advocate for the rights that were needed. And that was one method they used. If that didn't work, they would use just brutal force. They would kill off the leaders of a union. And that's historically been true in Mexico, too. So whereas when the labor unions were formed early in the United States, government and especially large corporations really were not as sophisticated on how to break a union. That's part of the problem that we have now, is these groups are very sophisticated. They got it down to a science, and they know how to do it. And so how that can be changed, I don't know. But that's not to say that unions are always good. I mean, we all know the history of how unions can be bad and how they can do wrong things. But how to protect people from being exploited for their labor in this agreement is the real question.
We have a whole workforce in this country perfectly willing to be exploited for labor in the high-tech industries. There's no unionization except for the traditional unions, like IRAs and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they seem to be really resistant to the idea of even doing that. And part of it is to remain flexible, I think. Right. So, if I don't like Intel, I go with Tech.
Yeah. Or whatever. Yeah.
But that's makes me nervous.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing is too, is if there is this cheap labor in other countries, then even if a company is willing to pay high wages, they probably can't compete with a country that goes down and uses cheap labor and then sells the thing for a third of the price that this company that's paying a fair wage does.
So some of your high-tech companies, I think Microsoft is an example, is hiring Indian engineers from India at $1.50 an hour, so they write software with programs that are implemented in the U.S. Keys in your comment about high-tech organization.
Yeah.
There's an interesting article in the New York Times just a couple days ago, and they were saying that basically the Mexican workers' wages are they've talked about it. There's been a fourfold increase in the cost of living down there in Mexico over the last year or so, but their wages have increased slightly. So this new industrialization of the cost of living that's taking place in the circumstances of the gathering that is driving many of them into poverty or so.
Yeah.
True state kind of stuff, not in terms of theory, but you were just lucky on the international law part, because by and large, even though there is a United Nations and some agreement, international law is not binding on any nation, really, unless you can get your judge to decide that it is instead of...
Well, none of the judges...
The United States has specifically exempted itself from the world court and the jurisdiction of the world court.
Actually, really,
right.
There's agreements, but they are agreements between the nations. There is no interaction.
This is probably the part I should bring up that I think is really important. Is that, and this really ties into what we were talking about with international wages as well, is we cannot, I don't think we can count on governments to do, we can't just say governments, because there's a law or a protocol, that they will do the right thing. And so what we were saying is that in terms of the immigration aspect of this whole issue, that we were going to initiate obedience to international law. In other words, we were going to say, and obviously, like what Judge Jackson said at the Nuremberg trials, he said that the German people should have initiated obedience to the Geneva Conventions, which were a higher law than their national law. And then he said that a person is not obligated to obey an inhuman law. And he said that even though the Nazis passed these laws, that people should have initiated obedience to international law to get their government, to actually change their government. And that's what, the only way we can do that is not by going to court, because the courts say, the judges in the courts are minions of the internet, of local or federal laws. They are not there to enforce international law. The only enforcement that can come about is for citizens to simply do it. And of course, what will happen in those cases, well, that you will be put in jail. But that you will also then demonstrate the conflict that now exists in our societies. And the second aspect to that conflict is that, so we need international standards of morality, that people are obligated to work under. And for example, we thought that immigration was a perfect example of how to do that, because in immigration, people exist, in a sense, between countries. So that's clearly an international situation. There are situations like, for example, there are Israeli soldiers who have said, we're going to take the right of in civilian initiative and not obey an order that tells us to kill specific Palestinians or do certain things. And there have been some Israeli soldiers that have said the same, virtually the same thing within their own country. So that's basically what we're saying, is not necessarily we expect or think that at first a judge is going to do that, that keep doing it, and pretty soon an enlightened judge will come along. And an enlightened judge will say, I'm going to set precedent, I'm going to say, these people obey international law and that takes priority. And it's just almost like other courts' decisions within our country. A lot of people, like Martin Luther King Jr., they just kept doing this until finally some judges said, okay. Well, he's first, then you, okay?
But what made it possible earlier for you, though, was that what was happening in terms of international law, the violation of the international law, eventually it was included in our national law, and that was the piece that you used.
Yeah, but it didn't win us anything. And that, even that didn't win us anything, because the judge didn't even let us use our international
law. Yeah, that's right.
So, now it did help us in that civil suit.
But it got you publicity.
Yeah, oh yeah.
The crisis point that I see, though, is you need to back up just one step and work on the church as an institution. Of course, which is a real difficult thing because, again, international law is an agreement between sovereign nations, and it could be unagreed, and then you don't have anything to hang on to. And you're dealing with countries that don't have the same tradition or expectations of the difference between church and state at all, not even close. But in the international situation that's developing, it's a matter of institutions dealing with one another, the way I see it, and how the institutions big enough to provide the power and the authority are either governments, international corporations, or the church. And if the church doesn't get its act together, then you just got the governments and the international corporations.
Yeah. And of course, the international corporations are not responsible to anyone except themselves, which is a truly frightening situation.
Yeah. What we found in the sanctuary movement is we had to view ourselves, I think, as much as a grassroots movement in the within a church as we're a grassroots movement within the country. In other words, we came very quickly to realize that the church was probably, in some of its sectors, going to be just as resistant to what we were doing as the government. And so we had to see that we had to do all these same things in the church. But the thing is it's not that clear, as people are both in the church and they're citizens and they're making their decisions partly because of their faith and partly because the law is pressuring them and partly because of their economics and so it's all mixed up with people, you know. But we had to, you're right. I mean, if we as a church could start to be more clear about these things, it would really help us. But it would also bring more pressure from the government on the church as an institution, too.
The church is a transnational institution, too. Uh-huh. So with enough networking there, you'd be able to resist that kind of thing. It's scary to kind of put some of the alternatives down the road.
It's an interesting statistic, you know, that most agreements between nations only last about 28 months, 2 years and 4 months before they're broken.
But this decision now in federal, the Ninth Circuit, this decision restricting tape recordings or
simply declaring that what they've done was illegal.
That decision now is a precedent. Have there been any other challenges of that?
Not that I know of. No, I haven't. One of the things that we're kind of afraid of is that we may have driven them farther underground. In other words, the big mistake that they made was that they went and spied on all these people, and then they said, here's where we spied, and they wrote it all down in paper, and we're going to use this as evidence against the sanctuary workers. Well, that's why we could had such a great case, is we had stuff they'd written themselves. It was this thick. And so now we're afraid, just to finish what I was going to say, is that now they will maybe just go in and gather evidence, and then they use some other way to break up a group. They won't necessarily bring a lawsuit and say, we spied here. They'll just send somebody in, and you'll never know who the spy was.
I've been involved in trying to snoop on governmental agencies through the Freedom of Information Act, which is another law.
Right.
You guys use that too?
Yeah, quite a bit, to find out just, you know, who's been spied on.
What they're up to.
Yeah.
Did you ever find out who the source of the mandate to instigate these investigations was?
Well, we do know that that the people that thought about it then went to D.C. and asked them whether they could do it, and they appointed a special prosecutor just to do it.
The
special U.S. attorney, yeah.
The Justice Department of the United States.
But we could never get specific names on that.